At long last, ladies and gentlemen, season 5 of Chewing the Gristle is indeed upon us. A convivial conversation fest between myself, Gregory S. Cawk, Esquire, and a variety of musical potentates from hither and yon. Brought to you by our friends at Wildwood Guitars and our friends at Fishman Transducers, of course, both of which I've had long-standing and continuing relationships with, and I'm very grateful for their continued support in this endeavor to bring you Chewing the Doggone Gristle. We've got a bunch of fun guests, some you have heard of, some maybe not so much. It'll be a little bit of discovery and a little bit of chaos all rolled into one. Thanks for tuning in, folks. Now, without any further ado, let's chew some gristle. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, we gather again for a mighty edition of Chewing the Gristle with yours truly, Greg Cawk. This week's guest is Taranzo Cannon, hailing from Chicago, Illinois. He likes to do things the Chicago way. Alligator recording artist, blues man extraordinaire, and hell of a cool cat, Taranzo Cannon, this week on Chewing the Gristle. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, it is time once again to chew the gristle. This time we have, hailing from Chicago, Illinois, purveyor of the Chicago way, blues guitarist, vocals extraordinaire, and southpaw, Taranzo Cannon. How you doing?
Hello, how you doing? It's all right.
I love the Jimmy hat. I love the Jimmy backdrop as well.
Yeah, I got to represent, you know,
I always remember, man. Years ago when we were at that store, guitar store in Evanston. What was the name of that joint?
The Music Garage.
Yes. Something like that. And you laid upon me a glorious assemblage of Jimmy video on a VHS tape, of which I savored for a long time. It had footage from the Newport Festival. And some other stuff. It was glorious. So I know you're a huge Jimmy fan, as am I. I'm absolutely, I'm not going to say YouTube. I'm a creepy fan, but I'm a big fan. So when did it all start for you with Jimmy?
This is all pre-YouTube when I gave you the VHS.
That's correct. Exactly.
Yeah. So it was like gold to see this stuff, you know?
Exactly.
Yeah. What started for me was I didn't know who Jimmy was until I started playing guitar, basically. And people would say, "Oh, you left-handed like Jimmy." And I'm like, okay, Jimmy, you know, that kind of thing. So I was digging reggae. Reggae was my thing, right? And so I got a bootleg cassette of Jimmy, and it was one of the ones where it was out of tune or the recording was warped in some way. And I'm like, this is the Jimmy dude they talking about? Like, what we doing here? Then I saw Monterey, and then that's when I was like, oh my God, like, you know, in front of the TV with, you know, the VHS, you know, and just looking like, man, this the dude they talking about. And that's what freaked me out.
Awesome. Yep. So you started guitar kind of late. You were like 22 or something like that, right?
Yeah. I'm 22, 23 in that area.
And so what drew you at that point? Because, I mean, most people, myself included, you know, puberty hits and you want to rock. It always seems like that 12, 13, 14 years old is kind of when it happened. So.
Yeah. Well, I was playing basketball. I mean, I wasn't trying to go pro or anything, but that was one of my things that I loved to do. I couldn't play ball anymore. So I was just sitting around and at that time listening to John Cougar and like heavy acoustic sounds and reggae and stuff like that and R&B. And I just asked my sister at the time to, you know, I was in between jobs, you know, being in 20s, you know, early 20s. And I asked her to buy me a guitar. She asked me what I wanted to play because she was practicing piano. And she bought me a guitar, acoustic guitar, $99 Harmony. Uh-huh. That I didn't know I was left-handed until I did this, or it'll be that for you guys, until I picked it up left-handed and I saw that the little string was on the top. And I wanted to do Redemption Song, Bob Marley's Redemption Song, and by the VHS that I saw, it was at the top. So I said, we got to take it back to the guy and make it left-handed or whatever, you know, put the big string on the top. I mean, I came into this thing very innocent, you know, which is like just trying to figure it out, you know.
So yeah. Reggae wise, what were your big influences? Because I kind of did a deep dive not too long ago. And I just, you know, I always just thought of it as, you know, coming from kind of a blues, rock, funk, you know, jazzy background. I always thought reggae was just, you know, and then I got into it and realized, oh no, there's all kinds of cool stuff going on here.
Oh yeah. Dude, the little bubbling, the skank, yes. All of that stuff, you know, yeah. the bubbling with the bass line, you know, right. Things like that. I don't know. It was just something about the hypnotic groove of it for me when I dug it, but you know, Bob Marley, Peter Tosh, you know, the Israelites, you know, just like a lot of the dub stuff too, I really liked, you right. know? Yeah, it was just, you know, I was just getting a lot of stuff. And then going back, listening to Chaka Khan and funk stuff, trying to figure that out too, in a way. And then every jam you go to in Chicago is a blues jam.
Right.
So, you know, I kind of did my thing with a reggae band for about a year and a half. And then their family started to move back because, you know, the bass player was really the guitar player and his son was the bass player. So when he moved back from Dominica, you know, they were playing like soca and things like that. You know, when he moved back, then that kind of moved me out of the band, you know, but it was good. I have fulfilled my, you know, feeling of trying to, you know, play reggae and stuff like that, you know, so it was cool, you know.
Yeah. So how much was blues around when you were young? Was it something that was accessible to you?
I didn't even know it was blues. It was just music my grandparents played. And, you Got know, it. And as kids, we used to have to go in the kitchen when all their company came. So, you know, but I would hear the Little Walters. I would hear the Buddy Waters, the Al Greens, the Coco Taylors. I would hear all of that, you know, that stuff in the front, what we call the front room, you know, and it was just, you know, it was just music that my parents played. But when I got older and started going to these jams, the people was like, oh, Little Walter, my baby. And I'm like, oh, my grandfather used to sing that, you know. So it was like a full circle moment for me, you know.
Excellent.
So, yeah.
So after your reggae phase, what was the kind of the first stuff that you started to get into that kind of set you on the course you are today?
Well, blues after. Because I did try to get another gig with another reggae band, but all the positions were filled, right? Because there's a bunch of guitar players all over the place. And so I just said, you know what, I'm gonna play some blues. You know, this is what I grew up around, a famous bar, Teresa's Lounge, where everybody used to go back in the day. And, you know, I didn't know the significance of that other than my uncles used to go down there and, you know, my uncle almost got shot down there. You know, that kind of stuff. So, yeah. You know, that kind of thing. So, so blues started to be like my kind of passion where I would start. I was on this blues journey after reggae, you know, and started realizing how significant Chicago blues meant to the world, you right. know, and I was like, oh, wow, I'm in a cool spot, you know?
Right.
So, you know, the soil is fertile here. I did not know that right. kind of thing. So I started doing a deep dive and really respecting, you know, the elders of the blues and really wanting to find out about stuff and connecting dots and things like that, you know.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So when were you playing with other people at that point, or did you start your own band right away, or what was kind of your path?
Oh, just jamming, going out to jams and networking with people. And I found a couple of cats that was just as hungry as I was as far as wanting to do something. I had a little bit of personality that I thought could carry a crowd, you know, for right. at least 30 minutes, you know. I transfer all my trash talking skills, but in a good way, you know, I kind of reformed them and put it on stage, you know. And, you know, from playing basketball, my little trash talking skills. and also just, you know, just that was a defense mechanism because, you know, I'm not the best player in the world. But I figure if I could talk to the audience and be cool, hey, everybody, how you doing? You know, they wouldn't throw tomatoes at me, you know?
Yeah, anytime you can avoid that, it's a good thing.
That's right, yeah, you know. It'd be like the Blues Brothers, you know, sing another round of Stand By Your Man. That kind of stuff. You know, the chicken wire. What's with the chicken wire? You know, famous last words for a band. What's with the chicken wire?
Exactly. You know? Exactly correct. Well, you know, it's an interesting thing when we talk about, you know, Hendrix, because Hendrix to me was you know, one of the ultimate blues players, because his was, you know, it was steeped in the tradition, but he always did his own thing with it. And plus it, you know, brought in, you know, otherworldly elements.
Oh, yeah. Oh, man, I dig sounds, like weird sounds and feedback and all that.
Right.
I like that sometimes just as equal as like licks, right. You know, because it seems like those sounds that they're making are a one off.
Right.
You know, and once he make them, it's like, you know, sometimes you probably can't bend that whammy and do stuff like at that pitch. At, you know, those seems very rare when you really get your feedback going, you know.
Right. Yeah. And I'm sure you're the same way, but now with YouTube, and it seems like people have posted every bootleg of every band, you know, entire tours every night, you know, and I find myself listening to a bunch of, you know, Hendrix, all kinds of different stuff. But some of my favorite Hendrix stuff was like an early 69, you know, and when he was on this Europe tour, and he just seemed, everything just seemed to be firing on all cylinders. If it was a good night, it was a really good night. And it was just like a tune like, you know, Red House would just go in so many different directions. You never knew what was going to happen. And it's just glorious.
Yeah. I mean, it's just, and I just listen. I mean, I know sometimes as Hendrix heads as we are, you just go back and listen to them, but you got to, you know?
Right.
You got to, you know, when you, and I'm sure you have a happy relationship with your woman and everything, but sometimes, when I was with, you know, my woman, it was like, sometimes I want to hear, I got to go put on the headphones, listen to some Hendrix, right. Just to get, you know, right. Just to be cool. And you just, you know, she's over there, you know, that's probably not a good thing to say. But anyway, anything that's bugging me, no disrespect to the ladies, right?
Right.
But anything that's, you know, as a musician, anything that's kind of bothering me, you kind of hear it, and then you look at your guitar, and then you hear it, look at the situation, look at the guitar. It's like, let me go pick up my guitar, right. You know. And that's no disrespect. That's just a calming thing that musicians need to have, I guess, you know.
So, yeah, and I don't know about you, but I still love just, like, playing along with records. If I get a moment where, you know, I'm alone, and someone, you know, the house is empty, and I'll just grab the guitar and, you know, maybe tune it to E flat and start messing around with Jimmy stuff. And I always find something new, even after all these years. And like, I didn't know he did it like that. Yeah. And then,
sometimes for me, and I'm not like a note for note Jimmy guy. Right. If I could just get in the area, exactly. But sometimes I have to look at other artists like Ernie Isley,
right.
Or, Randy Hanson or somebody to break down what Jimmy was doing.
Right.
Like I could see what they're doing kind of, you know what I mean? Because they're, first of all, they're right-handed. So it looks like a mirror image when I'm playing along with them.
Right.
And some of the stuff Jimmy was doing with the big thumb and all that stuff is intimidating, right. You know,
right.
The partial chords. And all that stuff. And it's like, let me look it on the eyes and see how he approached it. You know what I mean? Or my friend, actually, but he's upside down, Stan Skibbe. He's a Hendrix tribute artist. He lives in France now. But he plays upside down. So that's a problem.
Right.
You know, he does the Eric Gales thing, you know. So,
it's really hard to figure out what's going on there. It's like,
I know. It's like they're bending down. Can you bend down? I guess you can't bend down, you know.
Yes,
you know, that exactly. Kind of thing. But it's very cool. They got a signature sound with the pulling down other than the pushing up, you know,
right.
Factor.
The Albert King thing as well.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. You know, the Albert King thing is, a while back, I started messing around with the tunings. You know, Albert Collins, you know, it's like, because I always like to do Albert Collins type of sounding things that I just kind of figured out in standard tuning. But then for the hell of it, one day I was like, I'm going to tune it up to that F minor and capo up and just figure out what was going on. And it definitely has a thing. And same thing with Albert King. I was like, wait a minute, it's just kind of standard tuning, but he's tuned down to like C sharp. And then I messed with that. And then it was like all those bends became real easy.
Really? So are the strings like, you know,
rubber bands? They're like rubber bands.
Really? Oh, wow. Put my glasses on. I forgot I haven't been at my glasses on. My spectacles.
Yes.
But my Mr. Magoo's on. There you go. Hey, how you doing? I didn't know that. Put my Mr. Magoo's on.
I like it.
I don't know how old your audience is, but you know, Mr. Magoo was a cartoon back in the '70s.
Something tells me that most of our audience is going to know that very well.
Okay, all right. Very cool. So you know your demographic. I know my demographic.
Yes, exactly.
So what's going on with you? Like, you touring? What's happening?
Well, a lot of touring has been going on up and through. I think my last gig was that first weekend in December, and now we don't go out again. Well, actually, I'm doing first week in December. I'm doing a blues festival up in Madison, Wisconsin. And then the very next day, I'm doing this big benefit up that they have. It's kind of like this, all of these 90s stars. I did it last year, and I was filling in for Rick Nielsen as a part of the Nielsen family trust thing. So I got to play all these Cheap Trick songs, which was a blast. But then, you know, Soul Asylum was there and Fountains of Wayne people. And I was like, this is like 90s, you know. I hadn't heard for years, and we're just kind of, and it was a lot of fun. So I'm doing that on Saturday. And then Sunday, I'm doing a gig back in Milwaukee here. But then we'd be down by you at Fitzgerald's. I'm doing something with Nick Moss at Fitzgerald's on January 10th. We're doing a little, he's trying this thing where we're going to talk a little bit and play a little bit. And that's going to be fun. Okay. So I'm looking forward to it. And then we go out on tour. We go out west starting on the 19th. We go to Minneapolis, then Denver, and then Phoenix, and then out in California for a couple weeks. So,
man,
but it's been going good. I go out with my son and on drums, and then the organ player Toby from Minneapolis, and that's been a lot of fun. But I know you're recording another record for Alligator right now, are you not?
Yeah, we just last night finished like the whole mixdown thing. Now we go to mastering. You know,
excellent.
So, but I'm assuming there's going to be one last listen through where, you know, either I or myself or Bruce Iglau was going to be like, can you maybe, you know, one of them numbers, you know.
So Bruce is producing it then?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So yeah. This is, so you signed with him, what, like 2015? So how many records do you have out now on that label?
This will be the third one. The third one of the contract. So we're going to. I'm like, you know what? You know, what's the famous word of Jim Morrison? I'm going to get my kicks before the whole bleep house goes in flames.
Right.
I don't know what kind of, you know, I don't want to get you in trouble with the FCC, but yeah.
No, you can swear all you want.
well, right. Okay, cool. That's good to know. I won't do it now, but, you know, as it flows.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So what is your plan after the record will come out in...
Right before the summer, so whatever that quarter is, you know, right before, yeah. I don't know if I'm at liberty to say what the title of the album is yet.
We'll just steer people to your website so they can find out what's happening.
Yeah, but 12 new songs, you know, all original, all written by me, and just thoughtful commentary about the blues and things that you go through in relationships, you know, different takes of it other than just my woman left me type blues, you know?
Right.
You know, there's different takes like, she came back. No, right. she did 3 years in jail and now she's on my doorstep. Huh? What? No, it's not like that. No, but it's just, you know, different types of blues stories other than the same old ones that people tend to lean on, you know.
Right, I got you.
So,
yep.
So hopefully it'll be just as catchy as, you know, Sweet Home Chicago or something like that, you know.
Yes, indeed. Yeah. So what are your plans for touring then around the record?
Well, we got, it won't be out before that, but we will be playing, you know, to get stuff stage ready, you know, like, you know, not stage ready, but to get them to see how they feel.
Sure.
We're doing a cruise coming up in January, the legendary cruise. Then we got a tour in the Netherlands, doing Amsterdam and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And the Netherlands and Germany. Then we just got a little add-on from Bern, Switzerland. And we're going to be there a week right after the tour. and, you know, the Netherlands and all that stuff. So, but then before that, we're doing like Buddy Guys. We opened up for Buddy Guy.
Nice.
You know, we're doing a, Roses, you know, we're doing like local stuff.
Sure.
And then once we, you know, once we get on the road, man, it's, you know, it's the tour thing, right? You know?
Yes, indeed.
Yeah. Going overseas. I like touring now that I'm retired from CTA because I was a bus driver for like 27 years. So now I can like not be anxious of like, man, I got to get back Sunday so I can go to work Monday and been on tour for a whole week.
Right.
You know, that kind of thing, you know. Yeah. So, but I mean, I survived the little 27 year, you know, bus driving tour. Right. You know, that was a tour within itself, you know?
Right.
So, so I feel a little bit more freer now and more relaxed and, you know, and kind of wake up when I want to. Like my job now is a blues dude, right? Like I'm a blues player. Like this is why I pay the bills now. Like, wow. You know, along with the little money that I got from, you know, from the, driving a bus for 27 years. You know?
Sure.
Yeah, they well, give you a little stipend.
Nice. It's got to be nice at this point to say I did my time doing that, and now I can just do what I want to do.
Yeah, yeah. It's kind of strange, though, because it's like, I've been doing it now for a couple of years, but just waking up, like my gig now is 9 to 5, but 9 p.m. to 5 a.m., you know? You know? Like, yeah, I have a 9 to 5. Yeah, 9 p.m. to 5 a.m. because you can't go to sleep after some of these gigs. You know, you like wired, right? You know.
So you still play quite a bit down in Chicago. So what are the blues haunts that are still around? That are still the venues that people go to for specifically for predominantly blues, I should say.
Well, Kingston Mines,
right?
You know, they do the 9 o'clock, maybe 8 o'clock to 3:30, and then 4:30 on Saturdays. So they do the constant blues, you know, back and forth.
Right.
You know, two stages, the Buddy Guys. You got Blue Chicago.
Okay.
But then you also have places like, well, Fitzgerald's, they do different types of music and stuff, but it seems like they, you know, they do a lot more blues, maybe. Well, maybe not a lot more blues, but it's a nice mix.
Kind of a roots place, right?
Yes, yes. And Space in Evanston.
Right.
You know, but it's, you know, there was a blues club here called Blues on Halsted that they're going to reopen. Someone just bought the building this past summer, but it won't be open probably to another 18 months or a year and a half, something like that, you know. So, because he's got big plans for it and he's going to gut the whole thing and do a big thing. So, you know, that'll be out of commission for another year and a half.
Got it. Nice. So there seems to be an infrastructure for blues stuff in terms of festivals that are basically hosted by the various blues societies all over the country, mm-hmm. and so on and so forth. And clubs that are kind of affiliated with those different types of things and so on and so forth. And I just want to know, do you find that being an alligator artist and having that, you know, that the history of that label and so on and so forth, that it's an mm-hmm. automatic thing that you're into all these things, or is it still you got to schmooze or get in with all these different societies in its own way? Is it just like anything else, or is it still like you got a little bit of a leg up that you don't have to worry about coming at it from just scratch? You know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, it's like people know me now because they look at Alligator now, you know, I guess it added to my credibility or whatever, you know?
Right.
So some blue societies, they want me to come to their, you know, cause they see my show, you know, my show, I try to be, you know, 3D, you know what I mean?
Right.
I talk my little shit with the audience, you know, like, hey, what's up? Other than just, I'm going to play to you. Good night. You know,
right.
That kind of
sure.
thing, you know, it's kind of interactive. And I think these blues societies, they hear that Taranzo, you know, he talks his shit and he does that Chicago thing, you know, and here we go, you know, it's like, so yeah, I got the leg up when it comes to Alligator. He's put me in a whole different area of visibility, you know, which is cool, you know, but I still do my schmoozing. I still talk to the people, you know, talk to the audience or talk to promoters and all that stuff.
Sure.
It's not just a gig. You know, I just like hanging with people, man, you know, just
I'm
tripping,
with you.
You know?
Well, that's one of the fun things about traveling is you get to know people all over the place, and you just have these relationships with people all over the country and all over the world. And it's that's one of the funnest things to me about doing this, is that there's just this, you know, this crew of people that you meet through music that you would have never met otherwise. And it's just wild, man.
Yeah. There was a quote that I read with Jimmy. You probably know this quote, where he says, like, he feels guilty sometimes saying he's been to these cities, because you really can't enjoy sometimes the city because you're going from, and he said, we're like the circus in town.
Right.
You know what I mean? You turn people on, then you patch up your little tent. And I know how it feels, because sometimes you just want to hang out with people. Hey, man, what's going on? What's going on in the daytime, you know, here? But mostly our sound check is in the daytime. Then you go back to the hotel and just kind of land there and then go do the gig. And then you got to pitch, fold the tent up and go to the next
time. Yep, absolutely. That's a fact.
But it's cool. I mean, it's cool. And I never thought that a guitar. I'm so innocent when it comes into this, man. I never thought that I can travel the world with my music, or, I mean, this dude, I'm so humbled when it comes to, like, really people want to see what I got to say, like, with a guitar and my words. I never thought that would be an occupation for me, man. I just thought I wanted to be a social worker. That was my thing at first, being a social worker. And I took, before they call it, a gap year, out for college or whatever. I was at a Northeastern here in Chicago. So I'm going to take a gap year and go work for this little bus company, make some extra money. You know what I mean?
Right.
Then that gap year turned out to be 27 years. and then, along with the guitar. But I just never thought that would be my gig after. Like, playing guitar after you've been driving a bus. Like, I'm a blue collar dude, man. I'm out there in the elements. It's cold. You got to pick the people up and not kill somebody, but sliding in this, Chicago snow. You know what I mean?
Right.
But the guitar thing, like, you never know what your plans are until, I guess, it develop, I guess.
Right.
I mean, I'm not trying to be like a universe guy. The universe had this for me. But I didn't know, I didn't know what was going on. But now it's like, at this time in my life, like people, I was at the airport going to Minnesota, actually, a couple of weeks ago. And the person said, hey, Taranzo, like, you Taranzo? I'm like, yeah. Hey, man, I dig your stuff. And I was at the airport. I'm like, wow. Thank you, bro. it's weird, sure, man, that people like know me and stuff like that. I mean, it's cool though.
Absolutely.
I could be known for some bad stuff. Like, hey, man, you got my sister pregnant, man, back in 85. So like, that's like, no, it wasn't me. I'm about to whoop your ass. No, wait a minute. It wasn't me. But it was cool though, man. It's just cool to people to see you, what I mean?
Right,
I know
absolutely
who you are.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I saw Rick Nielsen at the airport, and I was like, hey, Rick, like that. And he looked, and I always say, my name's Taranzo Cannon. I'm a blues man from Chicago.
Right.
Like that. I always throw that blues thing from Chicago. That normally softens people up.
Sure.
Where they'll say, oh, Chicago. And then that gives you that, that
sure,
extra,
absolutely,
you can talk to him again. What's my man name from Iron Maiden? Rob Halford.
Right, right. Oh, right. From Judas Priest.
Judas Priest. I'm sorry, Judas Priest.
That's right.
We're in San Francisco on a gig, and I see, some commotion over there. So I'm, and I didn't know the cat's name, and I'm sorry, I don't own one Judas Priest, album.
Sure.
But
right,
I dig what the guy has put into the world, right? As a musician. And it's like, hey, this dude is... he's put some energy in the world that made people happy, right?
Right.
So I rode up behind him, and I'm just kind of walking. I'm saying, excuse me, Mr. Halford. And he said, yeah. But he kept walking, yeah, like that.
Right.
And I said, hey, I'm a blues man from Chicago, and I dig your stuff, whatever your thing is. And he turned around, he's like, and his voice changed. I was in Chicago 3 weeks ago or something like that, And then he started reminiscing about his time in Chicago. And I was like, that Chicago shit, man, I always slide that in there, man.
Right.
Bob Geldof, I met him in Rappersville, Switzerland, I think it was. Same thing. I said, hey, I'm a bluesman from Chicago. Next thing you know it, I had pizza. And, you know, it's like right. People get these good memories. And that's my little end. And next thing you know, we're taking a picture, mugging for the camera. You know what Perfect. I mean? That kind of thing. Yeah. So I don't know. Yeah, that's what I always tell my band. I always say you're from Chicago and you play music, you know. It might get you an extra some extra cheese on your cheeseburger or something. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. I mean, it certainly does. I mean, when you think of blues, you know, you certainly think of Chicago, and to say I'm a blues man from Chicago, it kind of cuts through it. There's no question as to who you are and what you do.
Yeah. You know, but I do always get that turnaround where they, you know, they give me another chance to say some more words. You know what I mean?
Right. Exactly.
Yeah. Cindy Crawford. I use it on her.
Oh, no kidding.
Y'all, man, she's like 6 feet, man. I was eye to eye with her, man. And I just told her, I said, hey, I'm a blues man from Chicago. And, you know, and I just wanted to, you know, to take a picture with you. And I gave her her professional space. You know, I did a selfie. Right. But there was room in between us.
Right.
She grabbed me from behind, like in a chokehold, and like put the drink close to the, you know, to the camera. I was like, Cindy, you know what I mean? Like,
nicely played.
Yeah, thank you, Cindy. You know what I mean? You know, she almost got a Me Too moment because I didn't want to be touched by a supermodel. No. I wouldn't dare Me Too Cindy Crawford. I wouldn't dare. But well, it was cool, though. It was nice.
I saw you know, a little something online. There was a little brouhaha about you talking about, you know, Chicago blues, and I don't want to get into all of that stuff, but I just want to know what your take is of if somebody asked you, what is Chicago blues versus what passes for blues? I'm doing the quotes with my fingers right now. Mm-hmm. So what would you, if someone said, what is Chicago blues to you? What would you say?
You know, I guess I'd say generic or cliche. It's real life situations. And for me, I try to write about real life situations other than just, you know, yeah, you have your good times and you have your party blues and the big booty and barbecue and all that stuff, you know.
Right.
I dig all that. But sometimes there's the nuances of, like, I wrote a song called Insurance, a funny take that, you know, we all need insurance.
Right.
You know, I talk about, I put colonoscopy in a blues song and people was like, oh my God, like colonoscopy, you know. Yeah. Polyps and all, baby. You know right. what I mean? But that's the blues, though, you right. know. So I would say, I encourage some of my peers here in Chicago to write more, you know, various songs about different types of blues. But I would just say it's of course truth-telling music.
Right.
And it's you know, it should be the nuances of blues, where it's like, if you can't, you know, if you can't afford ramen noodles, you know, that's, put it in a song.
Right.
If that's what I tell the young kids, you know, when they say, you have any advice, I say, get a passport and write your own songs. But don't write nothing that you don't know about. Now, if you ain't had no sex, I don't want no virgin telling me about how good, you know, sex is and you a virgin. You know what I mean? You know, write about, you know, maybe a coming to age type of blues. If you're a young man, like, I can't wait to, you know, have my first piece of, you know, good thing or whatever. Right. You know what I mean? You know, that's a blues where it's like, you're a virgin, but you want to do something, but you don't know how to approach it. Right from that standpoint, you know?
Right. Exactly.
But but I would just say blues is just like truth telling music and Chicago blues specifically. But whatever problems we have here, you know, every album, and I'm sorry to speak so like fast, but every album shouldn't be all, it shouldn't be about downtrodden type situations. There's enough of that. You know, if you can offer us a funny take on a situation, like I did, like divorce, you know, actually I wrote that song way before I got my divorce. So it was a premonition song of sorts, you know. You know, you write a tongue-in-cheek song about divorce or something like that, so people can kind of relate, like, wow, you know what? Because there's a 52% of Americans go through divorce.
Right.
So you kind of got a built-in crowd, you know,
right.
a demographic to,
absolutely.
So that you can, you know, especially in the audience. You know, people really dig songs like that, I think. So
absolutely.
I encourage like all blues guys to write original songs, you know, right. Really. I hope that answered the question. I'm sorry. Oh,
absolutely. Well, I think that's, you know, it's an interesting thing with anything these days is that there's, you know, well, you know what I've been really appreciating? Like my daughter, I know your daughter is a musician as well. My one daughter just has, Isla had started to write songs and play guitar and she's, you know, she's like, what does a producer do? You know? And so I've been listening to the Rick Rubin stuff and he really says some cool things. And one of the things that he says, like the audience comes last, you know, you've got to, and he's not saying that from a, like, you know, not caring about the audience, just that you have to make music for yourself. And if you believe in it with all your heart, then there's going to be enough people, hopefully, that are going to come along for the ride, as opposed to the other way of always second guessing what people want. Mm-hmm. And I guess with blues or anything else, there's just such a, you know, there's always going to be people in every genre. And I'm not judging them. I'm just saying it is what it is, that are trying to use every stereotypical and tangential relationship with, you know, the classics and so on and so forth to pull their own thing along. And in some ways, I mean, I have always really dug people who are purists, but do it just for the love of it. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And they don't, and do it from a point of view. It's like, yeah, we do this style of this era of, you know, let's say Chicago blues. And they do it really authentically, but they add some new blood to it, but they're cool with it. You know what I mean? They're not like, we do this because this is the only real music and everything else is bullshit. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I've been. Okay, now I could maybe get some of the other part of the question. I've been accused of, I guess, bastarding the blues or whatever. You know what I mean?
Sure.
You know, or not sticking to the lines of the 1-4-5, blah, 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 you know. That's why I wrote like some traditional songs to let my, and see, I don't have a problem with traditional artists, but some traditional artists have a problem with me.
I hear you.
You know, and my thing, my go-to, and I made this up years ago, and I haven't thought about it, but my first thought was Muddy Waters loved Sun House, but he didn't sound like Sun House.
Absolutely, right.
Buddy Guy loved Muddy Waters, but Muddy Waters, he didn't sound like Muddy Waters.
Right.
So the blues has a do a progression where it's like, you know, and on and on, you know, like Jimi Hendrix loved Buddy Guy and other people, you know, but Jimmy didn't sound like, so it has to move on. And I understand what people say, you're blurring the lines, you're doing this and all that. But I think in some context, the lyrics has to come through too. Like sometimes I need a couple of extra chords to get this storyline out.
Absolutely. Yep.
You know? And like you say, you have to make music for yourself. So if I'm not, if people don't like, you know, traditional listeners don't like the way I play blues, then I'm sorry, but listen to the lyrics.
Right.
Maybe listen to the chord changes. You might hear your 1-4-5 in there somewhere, you know, or whatever the case is. But, you know, I just like to write my music and because this is my blues. Right, you know what exactly. I mean? It's like, I don't know what it is to drink out a colored water fountain. You know what I mean?
Right.
But I know how it feels to try to get a house somewhere. You can't get a house because of whatever, you know, going on, you know, biases or whatever. But, you know, so I try not to write or sound like cats from the era because that's not my voice.
Right.
You know?
Exactly.
And that's not my, my story, you know, right. You know, my story is a divorced 55-year-old dude, you know, trying to figure it out.
Right.
You know what I mean? Taking care of my daughter, living life, still trying to, you know, talk sweet to a couple of women. You know what I mean? You know, hey, how y'all doing or whatever, you know, whoever want to help me cook a pot of soup, you know?
Right, exactly.
So, yeah.
I was just going to say some of the other quotes I see. One of my all-time favorites is Frank Zappa. And he just has some, every now and again, you know, you're scrolling through social media and there'll just be a little snippet of Frank talking, you know, and he'll talk like, he's like, listen, I don't make music for the people that don't like it. I make music for the people that like what I do. And I'm going to make as much of that music as I possibly can for the people that like it. If you don't like it, there's move on down the line. We interrupt this regularly scheduled gristle infested conversation
to give a special shout out to our friends at Fishman Transducers, makers of the Greg Kock signature Fluence Gristletone pickup set. Can you dig that? And our friends at Wildwood Guitars of Louisville, Colorado, bringing the heat in the shadow of the Rocky Mountains.
You know, I had a, I'm not divulging anything, but I had a little, you know, when you got a producer, you know, right, what I mean? And there's been things like go on the tape and then they have a different type of thinking about it. I had on one of my songs a sniffing thing while we, you know.
Right.
And it was very innuendo and very, you know, suggestive, but I was talking about blackberry pie,
right,
you know. But apparently, you know, one of the people in the studio, which is probably, you know, we'll probably figure out who it is, was like, women are going to think that you're like being vulgar. And I'm like, the whole song is a sexual innuendo. You know what I mean?
Right.
The song is called My Woman Love Me Too Much. You know, it's like, and the things that happen when your woman love you too much, you know, right, what I mean? You're hiding, you're hiding under the sink. You know, I've been singing that song for years, but the opening line is when my babies say, come and get some of this blackberry pie, you know, what do you think she's talking about? You know, right, that kind of thing. But at the end, I said, you smell blackberry pie? And I did a little sniff and he thought that was over the top. And I'm like, every time I sing that song, the women love it.
Right.
Like they dig it. But he was like, you know, the FCC or whatever, you know, XM radio or whatever, something might. I'm like, I mean, are we not adults? It's just a sniff.
Right.
So I'm like, you know what? Okay, forego the sniff. I'll get my sniffs somewhere else. You know, right, what I mean?
I'll save that for the live version.
That's right. Yeah. You know, but you know, I'm the dude that invite a lady up on the stage and put a guitar on her lap and start biting the strings. You know,
right.
I'm that dude. You know, so and it works because Howlin' Wolf used to take a champagne bottle, put it in his pants, and shake it up.
Right.
You know, and you know, and Buddy doing his thing. I mean, those guys used to be pretty vulgar.
Yeah,
you know,
no doubt.
But now you have to. I mean, I don't go out cursing at festivals and all that stuff, but I know a Buddy guy got accused of being vulgar and all that. And some festival put out a 4-page ad and said, we apologize for Buddy's language and blah, blah, blah. And it's like, Buddy is at that time was an 82-year-old dude.
Right.
You know, and you know what you're getting when you're messing with Buddy. You know what you're getting, you
right,
know.
Right, right.
And it must be a thing to be the last dude from that era.
Right.
You the last link from that era that's got some popularity that people like the Rolling Stones looking up at you. You know what I mean? Right. Even in their older age, you know. And just like, you know what? Kids can look up porn on their phones.
Sure.
Just because he dropped the F-bomb a couple of times at a festival. It's like, come on.
Right.
Come on, what are we doing? You know? Yeah, so anyway.
I think they're broken in with the ways of the world at this point.
They should know what little Tommy's doing, you know, when the doors are closed, you know.
Right.
What Jimmy say, no one knows where the nose goes when the doors are closed.
Right.
That's Jimmy right there. I love that quote.
Yes.
I love that quote. Yeah. But I get accused of messing up the blues, but you know, as far as not being traditional, but I do love the Elmore James and the J.B. Huddles and things like that. But what I say to blues purists is like, you're not pure. You're not. Once you put electric to that guitar, that's not pure blues.
Right.
A feel holler, that's pure blues. When right, you out there in the fields singing or you on the front porch with an acoustic guitar, you know, so what's pure to you is what I kind of offer to the purists. That say I'm not pure when they booed Bob Dylan.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Exactly.
You know, because he wasn't a pure acoustic guy, right?
Exactly.
You know, so the thing is, it's not that I'm Bob Dylan, but I'm just saying, don't say that I'm not pure when you're not pure.
Right.
You know, when it comes to traditional, because okay, how far back on a tradition you want to go?
Exactly.
Go to the cotton field and sing about escaping and getting away. You
right,
know what I mean?
Exactly.
That's pure. That's right. Uncut. That's right. Uncut blues right there. But once you get on the porch, okay, that's less pure. All right. But I get it. I understand. But then once you put an acoustic guitar, you put a chord in it, you're not pure no more.
Right.
So why bother me with a couple of extra chords?
Exactly.
You know.
Well, I don't know about you, but we're about the same age. I think I'm a couple years old, and I was born in 66. And 68. I don't know what it is, but you get over 50 and you get to be 55, and it's just, you just don't care anymore about that bullshit. Am I right? It's like
my saying, my give a shit wick burns quick. And it's like, I'll give a shit for a little bit. You know, it all rhymes. I'll give a shit for a little bit, but after a while, I'm like, you know what? Leave me alone with that, man. Go, do your thing. I do my thing. You know,
exactly. And there's room for everything. You know what I mean? It's like, I enjoy like real down home, like, you know, the guys that even dress period specific, whether it be, you know, old, you know, rockabilly bands, Western swing or blues bands. Oh. Whatever. I dig all that. And especially if they're really into that particular, you know, the way of production and so on and so forth. But don't be a dick about it, because that shit's been done.
I love to see the cats that know how to do the slide real good and that sound, because my thing is, and I did do a song called Unlovable with the slide. Right. And believe me, man, it was, thank God for the engineer, man, because he made me sound like I knew what I was doing. It was so many takes. It was worse than Gypsy Eyes, man. It was like 36 takes for me trying to slide. And I'm like, and he's a Jimmy guy too. Because I'm like, dude, we're going to be Eddie Kramer and we're going to be Jimmy and we're going to get this thing done. You know, right. That kind of thing. But I'm not a slide player, but I know a little bit around. You know, I'm not a nuancey player. But again, with his skills, he made me sound like I was more into something, you know. Because I love the Elmore James, man, and the old cats, man, because it's cool. I don't have a problem with traditional blues or cats that want to do that.
Right.
But don't throw rocks at my glass house. Don't do that.
Right, right.
You know, because, there's something to say about me, because if I'm bringing some people in, hopefully they'll look behind me and say, okay, well, who is his heroes? And I'll say, well, my heroes are Elmore James and J.B. Hutto and the Hound Dog Taylor. And you know what I mean? And I'll go back. I was thinking something the other day about I got a problem with people that don't look at their heroes.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
Like some people just say, Stevie Ray Vaughan, that's my man. That's all I need to see. No. Who does Stevie love?
Right, exactly.
And then who that person loved, you know, because at one point I was caught up on Jimmy, man. Jimmy was my dude. And I'm like, and then the blues album came out, and then I saw all the little faces, and the blues album was Lightnin' Hopkins. I love Lightnin' Hopkins. You know, Lightnin' Hopkins, Big Bill Broomsey, Muddy Waters, Albert King. You know, it was a collage of those pictures that made Jimmy's face. And that's when I was like, oh, shit. Like, I need to go back and listen to what they were doing, because Jimmy loved them.
Right, exactly. Yep.
So you know, I'm a firm believer now, and I just came into this, you know, saying or whatever, possibly from eating the edible. Don't don't tell Greg I'm eating the edible. Greg. No, but I came into this knowledge of, like, who are your heroes?
Right, exactly.
And then maybe you can get a clear picture of what was going on. You know what I mean? And then you say, oh, shit, like, I didn't think of that. You know, that kind of thing. So
right. That's always something I've always been kind of obsessed about, is kind of figuring out, well, where, especially like with everybody, but, you know, being such a big Jimmy fanatic, I would go, all right, well, where do those little fall off things come from? You know, da, 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 you know, those little fall, like, man, that, where did that cool shit? And then I was like, that was from Hubert Sumlin. You got that from Hubert.
I was about to say that. Because we know, like, yeah, that's Hubert Sumlin shit, man.
Right.
But you know what? I don't know where Hubert got it from.
Yeah, that's a good question.
A lot of stuff is, like, not even documented, because, like, like, you know, the run, All Your Love that Otis Rush does.
Right.
Yeah. There was a guy, and I forgot the name. Maybe it was Snooki Pryor, somebody. Snooki at one of these blues fests in Chicago said, Otis got this from me.
Uh-huh.
You know, there was a beefs back in the 50s, you know what I mean?
Right.
You know, and he did a song with that same little line.
Right, the minor thing, yeah.
Yeah, and I'm like, damn, like, you know what I mean? Like, yeah. You know, I guess Otis just got it first, you know what I mean? Like, he got the record contract or whatever, and then he put it on wax first or whatever. I don't, you know.
Yeah, it's interesting. When you hear stuff like, you know, when I finally heard the Chicago Blues Today compilations, it was much later on, you know. Mm-hmm. And when I heard Otis Rush on there, I was like, oh, well, that's where Clapton's whole Strat thing came from. You know what I mean? His approach on, like, Derek and the Dominoes, and the way that he played on some of my favorite Clapton stuff is how he played on the London sessions with Howlin' Wolf, that Strat sound and his vibrato and all that kind of stuff. And I was like, well, shit, that all came from Otis Rush.
Yeah.
You know?
Okay. And I didn't
Otis's
put those
vibrato
together.
And it sounded like Otis had some kind of like, it sounded like it was compressed. He may have even gone direct. You know what I mean? But but he does that version of I Can't Quit You Baby on there, which of course is where, you know, Zeppelin pilfered it from, that little ding, ding, you know, all that kind of that kind of stuff. So I've always tried to connect the dots. Well, where did they get this from? And where did they get that from? And then for the Hendrix thing, the little fall-offs thing, I thought, well, Hubert, but then I realized that Hendrix did a little touring with Albert Collins back in the day too. And of course, Albert always did that stuff.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, Albert Collins took Jimmy's place with Little Richard.
Ah, there you go.
After Little Richard fired him or left him at one of his girlfriend's house, you know, right. Little Richard, Jimmy was always late for the bus. Albert Collins took Jimmy's place. So they was around, you know what I mean? They was around each other, you know. Man, I'm sure Jimmy was looking and stuff like that. You know what I mean? You know? Bobby Womack is another one.
Yeah.
That toured before Jimmy was Jimmy, you know, that kind of thing. You know?
Crazy. But, man, it's interesting about all those guys, you know, and I've always, you know, made this kind of statement about, like, you know, because as you said, younger guys will be like, well, Stevie Ray's my guy. And then even younger guys than that will go, well, John Mayer is my guy. You know what I mean? And
of course, we're
like older guys going, what? You know, that came from this, that, and the next thing. But what's interesting is, like, you know, Hendrix and Clapton and Jeff Beck and Jimmy Page. And I mean, you can tell who their influences were, but they really, it seemed like either intentionally or unintentionally, they sounded different from who they were influenced by. They put it together in their own stew in a way that was really identifiable as their own. Whereas Stevie Ray, as much as I loved him, I mean, they were like, it was like verbatim specs of stuff of his influences. Like when you first heard those David Bowie records, you're like, who's doing those Albert King licks? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And he would do, and he culminated, he was a culminator as opposed to an innovator. And I don't mean that with any disrespect at all. You know what I mean? It seems that, you know, kind of the blues rock guys from them have been kind of that, you know, culminators as opposed to innovators. Whereas like Hendrix is like, you never before. And that's another thing that young guys have a hard time. Well, I hear that out-of-tune stuff of Hendrix's. Well, first of all, Jimmy never would have released that stuff in a million years.
Exactly. You know,
he was very specific. I mean, he hated Band of Gypsies because he thought he was out of tune, you know, and of course, in comparison to a lot of the posthumously released stuff, that's the least out of tune stuff that we'd ever hear from Hendrix and so on and so forth. But, you know, they listen back to that, but there was the world before Jimmy and the world after. No one did that.
You know,
whereas there's other people where you listen to it, it's like, yeah, it was done in various different degrees, but this person just culminated it differently. And again, I mean that with no disrespect, but it is what it is. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Yeah. No, because skill wise, the cat can still play. You know what I mean? Like, you know, but he had a hell of a template to learn from, you know?
Exactly.
Because, you know, and not saying Hendrix wasn't doing other people's licks, but he freaked it out somehow. Exactly. Where it was like, you know. And the two bigger amps make different sounds, and you know what I mean? And then you got more toys than Otis Rush just plugging straight into an amp.
Right.
Now you got some fuzz faces and all that stuff, and you do that oldest lick. Now it sounds a little bit
right
way out.
Exactly. You know? And you could, I mean, you, yeah, and you could tell that Hendrix was influenced by Albert King, but they weren't verbatim things.
Yeah. Well, I understand when Stevie Ray Vaughan did Let's Dance,
right,
for David Bowie. Now Rodgers was the producer.
Right.
And when David Bowie saw Stevie at Montreux, one of those shows, he was like, I want this guy on the album. And now Rodgers said, he sounds like Albert King. Why don't you just get Albert King? Right. Like that. You know, because Albert was still alive at the time, you know.
Right.
But David Bowie loved, you know, Stevie's show because he just saw him. He's like, no, I want this guy.
Right.
But that's what, and then now Rodgers said, I understood now, that kind of thing, you know. And he's like, okay, I understand. But his first thought, he said, was, go get Albert King. Like, Albert can do that. Right. You know, that kind of thing.
Right,
you
know? Right,
right. Stevie put speed to it. I think that's what freaked people out, too, because he put speed to it.
Right, and that tone. Know? I mean, that tone was...
And the tone, yeah.
Yeah. Was it? I mean, I remember when I first heard that record, I was like,
screamers.
That strat tone of doom.
The two tube screamers and all that stuff, you know what I mean? You know, I think it was two for the most part, you know.
Yeah.
But no, he was a hell of a player, man. But I understand as far as you create, because like I see these forums where people say, who did it better? You know, there's, you know, and it's like the original song of Hendrix, and then it'll be like a Stevie Ray Vaughan thing. And I'm like, yeah, that's because Stevie had a thing where, you know, it's like playing chess or checkers. Jimmy moved here and did that.
Right.
And played his, you know. Now you, as a person that's digging, you know, Jimmy, you can say, well, I'm going to approach the chords this way. You know what I mean? Because
right,
you already got the template from what Jimmy did, you know,
exactly,
and he just did it his way. So I dig both artists.
Oh, you know, I love both artists. What no
they,
doubt about it.
What they put into the world and stuff like that. But I'm a little bit, you know, Jimmy was the dude that made me feel like a little girl on the side.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like,
I'm
like,
with you.
Oh my God. B.B. King said, and we'll go with this. B.B. King loved T-Bone Walker.
Right.
Right. And if you notice the 50s B.B. King stuff, he was doing that T-Bone shit.
Yep.
You know what I mean? He was jazzy, right? He did an interview. They said, how you feel about T-Bone Walker? And he said, man, if I was a girl, I would have tried to marry T-Bone. And when he said that, I knew exactly how I feel, man. Because if I was a girl, I would have tried to marry Jimmy, man. You know what I mean? It's like, but it's not a sexual thing. It's just a thing of like, oh my God, this dude is you know, crazy good. You know,
right? Absolutely. Yeah, I feel the same way. Well, I think it's for youngsters. I think it's a fidelity thing as well of the recordings. You know what I mean? They hear something contemporary, and even though it's the same song that they're taking from someone like a Hendrix or even before that, they hear that modern production and that's their first exposure to that music. So then when they go back and hear the original, they're like, yeah, I like the newer version better because it sounds
more
consistent with, you know, modern things. And I mean, that's like the same thing when, you know, when you hear Crossroads from Cream and you're like, well, yeah, I guess this guy, Robert Johnson, is where Clapton got all this stuff from. And I guess the guy sold his soul to the devil to get his skills. And then you listen to those old records like, you're like, this guy got a bad deal.
That's right, yeah. He's burning right now for that recording? You know?
But then, you know, you go back and you really kind of put yourself in the headspace of listening to that old Robert John, and then you're like, then you're in. But it takes a minute. You know, it takes a while to acclimate to that, of trying to hear it in the context that, you know, of hearing it for the first time back then, and then hearing all the different nuances that these people took from it, from Muddy and so on and so forth. And basically how Robert Johnson was like the template of what would be the, you know, the electric Chicago blues band, rock and roll. It's all there. All the syncopations and stuff are there. But when you go from listening to Cream, you know, Marshalls and, you know, bashing drums and this shit's rocking, and then you hear this thing with all this scratchy scratch. You're like, wait a minute.
Well, you know, sometimes too, I have to, these people are so much, and maybe you've been through this too, they're so godlike. You can't imagine a dude in the 20s sitting there in a corner or whatever the studio was.
Right.
Like that was a real dude.
Right.
Like used to eat and take a shit or whatever, you know what I mean? And smooze women, whatever. That was a real dude. Like, just to hear his voice from right. the 20s. Yeah, that's 100 years ago. Well, almost 100 years ago. But, I don't know, man. It's this music shit is beautiful, man. You know,
it is.
I came home from Roses last night. Just kind of went out after the session, the mastering or whatever, not the mastering, but the mixing down. And I was, this young dude, Stefan, he's from Germany. I saw him last Sunday. And I'm sitting there, he's like in his late 20s, maybe early 30s. I remember when I came on the scene and I was looking at my heroes, local heroes like Carl Weathersby, Jimmy Burns, and, Carlos Johnson, a lot of older cats, Lori Bell. Mm-hmm. They were in their 50s when I was in my 30s.
Right.
You know what I mean? So now I'm the guy in the 50s. And my heroes are still like people like Jimmy Burns sitting over there almost 80 years old.
Right.
But he's still doing his thing. And I'm looking at this young guy come up like, and he's about 25, 30 years younger than me. And it's like, I felt a certain kind of like, wow, I'm the dude that, because I think he respects me. He was happy that I came to the show. And, you know, like cats I respected in my 30s were in their 50s. Now they're in their 70s and 80s and some have passed along, right?
Right.
And I'm thinking, damn, I'm about to be the 70, 80-year-old dude in 20 years.
Right.
And then he's going to be 55 and whatever his career takes him or the young people. And they're going to be saying, who's that dude sitting at the bar? Oh, that's Taranzo. He was big in the early 20s. Whatever, you know. Because at that time, it'll be probably 2050, you know what I mean? Or 2045 right. or whatever the year, you know, whatever the world can stand. Like, hopefully the world will be around in 2050.
Exactly.
You know. But I felt that kind of mortality where it's like, wow, like, I've been doing this now for like almost 30 years, maybe 20 something years, at least almost 30 years. Cause I was a CTA. So I've been doing this kind of like 30 years now, like where you get, it might not be big dollars, but I was a side man, I was on the scene and I got paid, that kind of stuff. So when you get your first dollar, then you're kind of professional, right?
Right.
You know?
Exactly. Yep.
How long you been doing this? Were you getting money, getting paid?
I think I got my first paid gig when I was probably 14 years old.
Wow. Very cool, bro. Very cool. Did you keep the dollar? Because I kept the first dollar I made.
No, I don't think I did. I just had at it. Well, I was lucky because I got into a band, one of my buddies from eighth grade. His older brother was a senior in high school. Actually, he was a senior when I was a freshman, and he hired me to be in his band. And so I was playing at, dances and, even bar gigs because, drinking age was 18 and I was a tall, gangly mutant back then.
Oh,
so I was able to get into bars, without any problem with my peach fuzz mustache. And, but yeah, so it started early and it just went. And, I've been doing it for a long time. And it's kind of funny you should mention that thing about guys in their 50s. I don't know about you, but when I was in my late 20s playing all the time, mid-20s, playing all the time, and I would play with some of the local guys that had done big things. You know what I mean? They'd gone out mm-hmm. and played with this person, and this person was a sideman for them, and they were in this band, and they all kind of came back to Milwaukee and were just kind of gigging musicians and stuff. And I was like, they're in their 50s. Like, oh, my God, they're so old. You know what I mean? Like, why do they even bother anymore? You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Holy shit, now I'm that age and people are like, oh my God, he's a dinosaur. You're like, well, yeah, but I'd like to think I still have something to offer, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Oh, dude, it's like, what hit me too was looking at an old thing with Billy Branch and like the Chicago Cats in Germany. And they were, at that time, they were in their 40s.
Right.
And I was like, wow. And now I've just played a gig with Billy Branch. He's like 70 years old.
Yeah.
And again, seeing Jimmy Burns last night, he's like 80.
Right.
And I'm like, I remember the first time I saw these cats and they were just, not saying they're not young and spry, not spry, but young or whatever, but they still valid. They still have right. something to say.
Exactly.
And I hope when I get that age that I still have something to say and there's not some young kid, like you say, looking at me like, who's the old guy at the bar talking shit? You know, it's like, you know, he gets drinks all night long, or, you know, people seem to like him, but who, you know, who is that? It's like, oh yeah, he was the Alligator Records. Blah, blah, blah. You know, it was like no big deal for the, he was. And because I never looked at my local heroes like that, where it was just like, because they are the reason why I'm doing it, you know? In these clubs, they were, had a show that carried a club along with other musicians. So that club can continue to be open and present blues as such, or whatever the case is. And then here I come up through the ranks because of them. You know, it's almost like they kept the club open with their talent until I came along. You know what I mean? Because, and there's various bands. Whoever played before me in Chicago, Dion Payton, you know, Johnny Dollar. I mean, all of the guys that people might not really know, but these guys paved the way for the clubs to stay open so Toronto can get a gig. You know what I mean? Yep. Kings of Mine's been open since 68, I think. I was born in 68. But they did a bunch of gigs till I got old enough to come in there and say, okay, you know, you guys can keep playing if you want, and if you pass away, hey, say hello to, you know, to my grandmama and everything, you know what I mean? You know, and then I'm coming doing my thing, and cats coming up behind me, this, you know, young, and they see, you know, like I talk to Kingfish all the time, and you know, Kingfish is doing his thing, man.
He's great.
I'm so proud. I'm proud of that young man. I mean, playing on the roof of in London, you know what I mean? Like for the Hard Rock Hotel. I'm like, man, I remember that dude. He was 15 years old and he was reaching out to me to get Chico Banks is another local guy that we love here in Chicago, a musician, a blues guy. He passed away at 42. But he just wanted some stuff on Rico McFarlane and Chico Banks, and I said, I was sending him everything. I didn't know who he was. He was just a little kid wanting to know about Chicago shit, you know? And all of a sudden, he's Kingfish now.
Yeah, you know? That's awesome.
And yeah, that's always been cool to me, man. That's always been cool, you know?
Excellent.
Yeah.
Well, listen, my friend, thank you so much for taking an hour or so to chew the gristle, if you will. It's been great.
Thank you.
Great hanging with you. And it's been a while.
Yeah, it's been a while. I should be in town. What day? Is that like a Tuesday or something?
It's like it's a Wednesday, I believe. Yeah.
I should be in town, but I don't do the cruise thing until the end of the month of January.
Awesome. So, well, come on out and say hello.
Yeah, I will. I will.
Awesome. Right,
and thank you for your time, man. And thank you for putting me out there.
Oh, my pleasure. Absolutely. Thanks you for doing this. And happy holidays. And hopefully I'll see you in January.
Right on, man.
All right, take it easy.
Peace sign.
Have a good one.
There he is, right there. There you go. Peace, man. All right.
See you later. All right. Thank you so much, folks, for tuning in. Special thank you to Wildwood Guitars of Louisville, Colorado, and the mighty Fishman Transducers for making this podcast possible. If you enjoyed yourself, ladies and gentlemen, please subscribe and review, so that people can get the word out that this is worth experiencing. Can you dig it? Thanks again. We'll see you soon, or you'll hear me soon.